Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 40% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
David Newton covers the Panthers for ESPN.com. He's the John Keim equivalent covering the Panthers. We always say that, David, to anybody that we have on, because John's a good friend and he's basically on this show once a week for the last 15 years. But obviously I reached out to you because of the news that Marty Herney is potentially on the verge of becoming Washington's new general manager. You've covered him, and obviously he's been there in two different stints, 2002 through 2012, and then came back in 2017. I'll start with the obvious. What would Washington be getting in Marty Herney if they hire him to be the general manager?
Well, they've got a guy that's a great talent evaluator, and more so they've got a guy that Ron Rivera trusts. And I think when you're hiring a GM, having that trust and that collaborative effort that they need to have between a head coach and a GM is very important in building a team. And Marty, you know, he's a really good people person. He's hired good people in the past. If you look at Buffalo right now and where they're at, Brandon Bean, he hired him as kind of an intern way back when, and Brandon moved up to assistant general manager and now to a general manager of the Buffalo Bills. And he's really been good. He's been really good at first round picks. I think, he's had some misses in the lower rounds, but I think he's a solid pick for them. And again, it's kind of like a homecoming for him, but this is kind of where it all started with him being a reporter back in Washington and then learning how to be a GM.
Yeah, it's a crazy career path for him. You know, I have followed it a little bit from afar because I remember when he was a reporter and a beat reporter covering the team, and he obviously became, you know, close with Bobby Bethard at the time, who took him to San Diego, and that really launched his career in professional football, which, you know, has been, obviously a unique path to a general manager in the league. You know, one of the things, David, and we're talking to David Newton from ESPN.com, who covers the Panthers, one of the things that I've read about Marty in the past is that he's more of an old school, you know, general manager. You know, he wants to hear the sound of the ball hitting the mitt, you know, from that movie, Trouble with the Curve, I guess it would be. And David Tepper's more into the new age analytics kind of guy. Is that a fair description of Marty or not?
Yeah, I think it's totally fair, and I don't think it's a negative that he's kind of old school. I'm not so sure how the analytical side of all this really fits into evaluating people and talent, to be honest. I understand how it fits in when you're in games and situations where you've got to make these tough calls. But for the GM, I'm not sure exactly how that works, to be honest. Maybe I'm a little old school, too. So, but I think definitely that Marty's that guy that, he likes that in-person conversation to get to know somebody, to understand their ins and outs and what they are as a person, not just as a player. And, you know, he's a good example of what he is, I think, and it's never really been written, or he'll probably never admit to it, but like when they got off to the rough start with Ron Rivera way back in 2013, the rumor is he fell on the sword. The owner wanted to fire the head coach, and Marty, from what I understand, said, "No, fire me. I think he's a guy that can win games for you." And that season turned around. Back in 2012, but that season started to turn around. And in 2013, it just took off, and they made the playoffs and won three straight NFC South titles and made it to the Super Bowl. So when things started falling apart a little bit after the Super Bowl, that's the guy that, you know, Marty's the guy that Ron wanted to come back, and so they hired him back to replace Dave Gettleman. So yeah, he is old school, but he's also a guy that's loyal and everything that I think that Ron Rivera wants in a GM.
You know, I'm not sure I knew that story. So essentially, after Rivera's second year, in which they, you know, in Cam Newton's second year, they went 7-9. And this was before their run of, you know, four playoff appearances in 5 years, including the 15-1 season in 2015. So essentially, Marty Herney said, "No, fire me. Don't fire the coach. You've got the right guy." And that's why Herney was out in 2012.
Yeah, they were, I think, 1-5 or something like that to start off 2012. And you know, Jerry Richmond was fed up. Now, this story has never been printed. And again, Marty's not going to admit to it. But, you know, insiders say behind the scenes, that's kind of what happened.
Interesting. That would also, you know, speak to the bond that the two have. Can you speak more to the relationship that Herney and Rivera had and how well they worked together and what, you know, sort of the dynamic was? Like, how much input did Rivera have? Because here, David, Rivera is in this coach-centric, you know, model. He's the final say. How did it work with the two of them?
I think it was a great collaboration. I think they met, they talked, they agreed on those things. When they didn't agree, I think ultimately the head coach gets the final say in that. And it's interesting you say that about how the power alignment there, and you see it in other places too. But I was talking to Bill Polian, a Hall of Famer executive that was a GM here and other Buffalo and Indianapolis. And it was interesting when I asked him about that, and he said, you know, the head coach has the final say on almost every case anyway, regardless of how the power structure is set up. He said, I think talking about who has the final say is very, very, very overrated, because he said, I had two situations in my entire career where talking about who has the final say is very, very, very overrated, because he said, I had two situations in my entire career where I really didn't maybe totally agree with the head coach, and both times, you know, we went with what the head coach wanted to do, because, you know, he's the guy that's got to put the players on the field. So I think that Marty and Ron have a good understanding of what Ron wants to do, particularly defensively, where, you know, that's his strength as a coach, and he brings the type of players in that'll fit his schemes and what he wants to do.
Talking to David Newton, who covers the Panthers for ESPN.com, that's interesting, because Marty's mentor obviously was Bobby Bethard. I'm guessing that was really his mentor. You know, Bethard was the one that took him to San Diego. And the interesting thing about what you just described is that, you know, Bethard ended up moving on from Washington because, in part, Joe Gibbs wanted more of a say in personnel, you know. And I'm not saying that there wasn't collaboration between Bethard and Gibbs, but Gibbs wanted a lot more of it, which ultimately, you know, resulted in the two parting. You mentioned, and I've heard this about Marty, very good with draft choices at the top of the draft, not so good with, you know, middle to latter portions of the draft. Would you identify that as a weakness?
I guess. I mean, he's had some hits on the you know, middle, lower part of the draft. I think Josh Norman's the one that stands out to me.
Sure.
I know Josh never really worked out there at Washington, but, you know, he's a guy that went sixth round, whatever, here, and turned into a Pro Bowl player. And he's hit on some other guys. But I think you'll find a lot of that around the league in general. Yeah, I think quarterback was a big issue for him for a while there because they really never hit big on a quarterback. Trading for Jake DeLone was probably his biggest move back when they got that. And then getting Cam Newton, of course, and he and Ron had to be on the same page for that one. So, again, if you got to hit on your first round, second round picks. And if you don't hit on those, you're doomed anyway. So I don't read too much into some of the misses they've had in the middle to lower rounds.
There's a guy here, Kyle Smith, A.J. Smith's son, who has essentially been in charge of the draft board, unless the owners got in the middle of the pick, like with Dwayne Haskins. And he's done a really good job with the draft here in recent years. When Marty was in Carolina as the general manager, did he have a significant right hand in terms of the draft, or was that something that he ran pretty much start to finish?
He ran it pretty much start to finish, but he did have some solid people under him. And Brandon Bean was the guy that was that guy for him for a long time here before he went to Buffalo. Never really got that type person you felt was that astute to the talent evaluation here the last time around. But, and another example I want to mention here is Jeremy Chinn. And Marty went to the Senior Bowl last year and just fell in love with the kid. And they traded up to get him. Ironically, traded with Seattle, and now they've got one of Seattle's executives coming in to be the Panthers' new GM. But Jeremy Chinn, I thought, had one of the best seasons of any rookie out there. I know you got a great one up there in Chase Young, but I think Jeremy Chinn was probably at least co-defensive rookie of the year the way he played. So, I just think Marty is a guy that he likes to be there and he travels all over the country. He's all over at games all the time. So he's a guy that's up front really making those talent evaluations.
But by the way, I know Derek Brown had a slow start to the season, but he really came on and ended up being a really good player this year at Carolina, right?
Yeah, and ESPN was doing a redraft, and a guy for me at number 8 again, and Derek Brown's still sitting there, and I took him again. I said, why would I give up the chance to take the best defensive tackle in the draft last year? There were a lot of issues with what Derek was going through to get him off the slow start. I think K'Wan Short, their Pro Bowl defensive tackle, you know, was out after the second week and never played again, and not having that kind of a star beside him to kind of take some pressure off really, I think, slowed his progress a little bit. And he always played hard. I think that was the one thing that they loved about him. He played hard, and he made mistakes, but he did it 100%. So I think he's a guy that still has a bright future here.
Talking to David Newton from ESPN.com. By the way, just for those that don't know, Jeremy Chinn is probably going to finish in the top 3 or 4 for defensive rookie of the year. You know, Chase is going to win it. Antoine Winfield Jr. and Jeremy Chinn are sort of considered the contenders to finish second in the voting. You know, I think that's one thing that in thinking about Marty, I focused less on until late last night. I mean, he was involved. He came back in 2017. Right, so he was involved in the McCaffrey, the Curtis Samuel, the DJ Moore, the Brian Burns. Again, very high draft choices, but guys that have panned out. Not all these guys do.
Yep, I agree. I mean, his first and a lot of second round picks have panned out for the most part over, you know, his stints. I was there back in when he first came to Carolina. I was still working for another organization then, but you know, way back in 98, he actually came in, but general manager basically from 2001 on. He built the team that made it to the Super Bowl in 2003, and you know, Julius Peppers was kind of the cornerstone of the defense there. That you know, future Hall of Famer players like that. So you know, he made the deal to get Jake DeLone. So he's had an impressive career. I mean, even building the team that the Panthers had when they went to the Super Bowl in 2015, Dave Gettleman gets a lot of credit for that since he came in and was the GM then. But if you look at the foundation of that team, Cam Newton, Luke Kuechly, he traded to get Greg Olsen, which I thought was one of the best trades he ever made. I mean, just the list goes on of star players. I mean, and there are others on other teams right now that you can look at that are having good careers here. You know, like at Buffalo, you got Mario Addison's playing well up there. And you've got some other players at Buffalo. In fact, Buffalo, we've been calling jokingly, you know, Carolina North or Panthers North. And Washington's kind of becoming that too, I guess.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, it's funny too, as you're talking, I'm sitting here and looking at Gettleman's drafts, you know, in the years in between Marty version 1, Marty version 2, and they weren't nearly as good as Marty's drafts, nowhere near as good in the early portions of those drafts. You mentioned, you know, one of the trades for Greg Olsen. How is he graded out in your mind with respect to trades and free agency?
Good, not great. Again, Olsen was a great trade. Bringing in DeLome back in the day was a great move to get him from New Orleans. You know, he's also had some misses too. So, I mean, I think he prefers to build through the draft and build around that young foundation and probably isn't as known for making the picks that you're talking about. But, again, you're right, that Dave Gettleman picks. That's a big reason he was gone. I thought the team was weakened. They made it to the Super Bowl, but I thought because of the poor drafts after that, along with a lot of injuries, especially to the quarterback, that was the reason that team went downhill and downhill fast.
One other thing, and I'll let you run, and I really appreciate the information. Rob Rogers worked in that organization. He's the senior VP of football administration here. He is essentially now the cap guy, the contract guy. What was that? Did he work for Marty? And did Marty have those responsibilities in Carolina? And how would you see that playing out here?
No, I think it'll be the same way. And Rob, you're right. He was the guy that was the cap guy. He did all the figures. You know, Marty was more the talent evaluator, and he was the guy that had to give the player the hard news that, hey, we've got to move on from you. Not to say he wasn't involved in some of these negotiations. One of the negatives on Marty early in his career, the first go around with the Panthers was he was loyal to a fault where he gave veteran players contracts larger than they should have gotten at that point in the career, and maybe just giving them a contract period at that point in the career. And that kind of got them in cap hell, to be honest, for a while. And that's one of the things that Dave Gettleman did so well is it got him out of that. But that was probably one of his biggest faults earlier. And he did, and he'll admit that. And he said while he was out and he was actually working, it was funny again, he's kind of back to his old world as sort of a journalist, I guess. He was doing what you're doing. He was hosting a radio show. And he was, he was really good at it. And he was talking about how he learned watching what Dave Gettleman did, and how he wasn't well, how he had to let those star players go and move on from them and not give them the big contract to continue the career. So, I think he's learned a lot over his career, and it's made him better every stop.
David, thanks so much for your time and information. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Good to be here.
Yeah, David Newton, at D Newton ESPN, covers the Panthers for ESPN.com. Some very interesting information. Something I had not heard, maybe you all had heard, is that the reason Herney got fired in 2012 when they were 1-5 is he fell on the sword. The owner, Jerry Richardson, wanted to fire Rivera, and he said, no, you've got the right head coach. I'll fall on the sword for him, and he did, and he was back in 2017. And if you do look at those drafts, his draft set up the championship run, and Gettleman's drafts were not nearly as successful. You can go look at them, Kelvin Benjamin, others that were taken early that didn't work out. Chris Nockey will join us next. Maryland is at Michigan tonight. We'll talk some overall college hoops, too. Been a unique season so far. And then Mark Zuckerman, our Nats insider, on the John Lester signing. We'll talk to Mark at about 8:45. Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980, Team980.com. The Mets did fire GM Jared Porter this morning. Porter was part of an ESPN story where he was sending explicit, unsolicited texts and images of his you-know-what to a female reporter back in 2016. Advice given earlier in the show, if you're not asked for a pic of your don't send it. It's really not that hard. And Neil in Rockville, our legal contributor, did say when I equated this texting of your private parts as the modern day flashing. He did tell me, yes, flashing is illegal. It's indecent exposure. I knew that it was. I just didn't. I just was confirming. Chris Nockey is our guest. Of course, you will hear him tonight as part of the call of Michigan and Maryland with Johnny Holiday and with Walt Williams. Tip time, 7 o'clock. You know, this game, first of all, we've had some conversations privately about the two teams involved, many about Maryland. I thought Michigan, when they played Maryland on New Year's Eve, was the best team not named Gonzaga that I had seen all year. And Maryland had played them until Minnesota beat them the other day, as tough as anybody did. Your thoughts of seeing Michigan the first time, and then I know they were missing a player on Sunday when they lost to Minnesota, but what kind of challenge, Nockey, is this for the Terps in their first real game since that upset win at Illinois?
Well, first of all, Kevin, thanks for having me, and I appreciate the intro where you go from a serial dumbass directly to, directly yes. to me.
What's wrong with people? Do people really need to be told not to send those kinds of texts?
62 unsolicited and unanswered texts, I think he sent, and he still decides to send Mr. Happy over there. You know, it makes no sense to me. But so I would agree with you on your assessment of Michigan. And that said, I thought the Minnesota outcome this weekend was fairly predictable. Minnesota's having a really good year. They continue to be very good at home, even though a lot of college basketball is upside down in terms of, away teams having a lot of success. That's for obvious reasons, of course. You don't have the crowds. But and Michigan was due to lose. You know, it's just so hard to keep that up, keep that level of play up against conference teams that know you well. They had just played Minnesota, 10 days before or something like that. I don't know what the number of days that separated. So, I thought that was fairly predictable. The outcome, the margin was not predictable. Minnesota waxed them pretty good, but Michigan losing was, yeah. So Michigan was without their starting two guard, Brooks, and he's a very good player. I think one of the things that was lost in all of the Michigan Hunter Dickinson BS that sort of happened in College Park was the play of the Michigan backcourt was flawless. And Smith, the guy that transferred in from Columbia, was just rock solid on the ball. Brooks, a very good defensive two guard, and they penetrated at will against Maryland in that game. And the play of those guys in particular was something that was completely lost with all the, like I said, with all the stuff regarding Dickinson.
Talking to Chris Nockey, he'll be on the call tonight. Michigan, number 7 in the country, hosting Maryland. They beat Maryland 84-73 on New Year's Eve, a game in which Maryland actually led Michigan by 4 in the second half, and that was when Daryl Morcell was injured, and it hurt them not to have him. I'll tell you what, watching that game, I never felt like Maryland was going to win the game. They were shooting lights out at one point. I think they were 10 of 12 from behind the arc, and it just looked to me like Michigan was just so much more talented. I think Franz Wagner, by the way, Mo Wagner's brother, Nockey, to me, he looks like a lottery pick.
Well, I have the pleasure of doing and the privilege of doing the games with Walt Williams. And Walt watched him play for 10 minutes. And he said, that guy is an NBA player. He is really something. And so I agree. I mean, part of that caveat there is you have no idea who's coming out, who's staying, and all that stuff. But he's a very good player. He's got a lot of wing skills. He's not like his brother, sort of locked inside, kind of a face to basket /5. Yeah, he's got a little edge to him too. I think he's got, he's a bit of a hard ass. You know, he'll play really hard on the defensive end. He's disruptive, and he's an unsung hero there for sure.
So, you know the fan base, and I've talked a lot about the Maryland basketball fan base on the show over the years. For those that aren't so familiar with it, it's as passionate a fan base as you can have. It's also a highly critical and a highly scrutinizing fan base. It expects to compete for championships in the Final Four every year, even though it hasn't for a long time. There's a lot of criticism already about this year. I actually think they've overachieved. The two wins at Wisconsin and at Michigan are two of the best road wins in the league this year. My question, though, is about the league and the setting, because this has a lot to do with their record right now. Naki, I think this is the best top-to-bottom league that Maryland has ever played in. And you've been there courtside for some of the best years in the ACC. And when you were coaching or when you were a player, you know what the ACC was like. I don't think Maryland's ever been part of a top-to-bottom better league. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about it, Kevin. I mean, even back in the really great ACC years, you know, like 1 through 8 could be really, really tough, and there was no easy game anywhere in that top 8. But you always found some respite somewhere, a place where you could go get well. And there is no such place. And add to that the fact that, not that Nebraska is a cakewalk, but even that game was taken away from the Terps because of COVID issues on Nebraska. So basically what it means is you go from, you know, from playing Illinois to basically, you know, 10 days later, you're at Michigan, then at Minnesota. There's just no rest at all. And I've been so impressed by the level of play, the level of coaching. And there have been some great road wins. I mean, it's just a bunch of really, really good teams. I don't know that there's a great one. I would say that Iowa is the best team in the league, but that's just my own opinion. But, I mean, there are a lot of really good college basketball teams and a lot of old college basketball teams. Wisconsin has 4 guys who are fifth-year seniors. You know, we've seen Iowa. Luka Garza has been there, what, 12, 13 years now. So you just, you know, there, like I said, there are no easy outs anywhere you turn.
Yeah, that's interesting that you think Iowa's the best team. I think it's Michigan just because they defend, and I don't think Iowa does.
Yeah, I just think Iowa can outscore you, and ultimately you will have to get some stops. I just think they're talented in all the right places, very skilled. And, I it'll be interesting to see down the stretch of the season how it all sort of pans out. I think Garza in a tournament game, with all those shooters around him, is a pretty tough matchup for folks.
All right, so let's talk about Maryland. I've had so many arguments with some of my friends who are, you know, always in the "he's not good enough, Turgeon's not good enough" camp. I actually think he's doing an outstanding job this year with an undersized team in a big league and a great league. I think these two wins at Illinois without Eric Ayala, by the way, and at Wisconsin are two of the better road wins in the league this year. What do you think of the team and the job he's doing so far?
Well, sometimes it doesn't matter what I think, because I get branded a homer regardless. But I said before the season that if Maryland, with this group and in this league, if they won 10 games in the league, the Terps should be the runaway coach of the year. And I would stand by that. I think that there's a lot to bite off there, not the least of which, Kevin, is Terps continue to pay on the recruiting on a recruiting basis for the gifts to keep on giving. That would be the Mitchell twins. You know, you expect to have 2 6-10 guys in your program for 3-4 years, and they're gone. It also eliminated guys that maybe you could have recruited that aren't a part of the program. So you're left shorthanded in a year where you don't want to be shorthanded inside.
But you got to put that on him. That does fall on him.
I would agree with that is a collective coaching staff decision. That said, every coach thinks he's a social worker. Every coach thinks it's going to be different with me, you know. Yeah. and it rarely is. Mentioned the Ayala thing, and I'm saying these things. I have no access to Mark Turgeon anymore because of COVID. I don't get a chance to visit with him before or after a game. The last conversation I had of substance was last March after they'd beaten Michigan. And you know, Ayala being out, I love Eric Ayala. I love him. But him being out makes them a better defensive team. I mean, he's going to help when he comes back. There's no question about it. But he was struggling to stay in front of other guards. And maybe he comes back healthier. I hope so. Because with him out, you know, Hakeem Hart, Daryl Morsell, Aaron Wiggins, those guys are doing a really good job on the perimeter right now. So I think Turge has done a good job. I think he gets a lot of vitriol because he's followed a legend. It's impossible to follow, you know, Gary Williams. That's a part of it. I think the style is a part of it as well. I think he's a really, really good basketball coach whose players play extremely hard for him. And ultimately, to me, that's a big, big part of the job is to get guys to play for you, and these guys play for him.
Last one. Who's been surprising to you in terms of their performance this year, for better or for worse?
Hakeem Hart, far, far better than I'd given up on him, to be quite honest with you. And I was hoping that when James Graham announced that he was coming in, that he would take some of those minutes. But he's a far better player than I ever gave him credit for. And he's done a really, really good job at multiple positions. On the downside, I think that some of the guys on the bench, I wish some of the guys on the bench were a little bit better, including the two freshmen, you know, and they've been a little bit up and down, the two freshman guards, I should say. So it's a process, man. You got to grow. You got to get better as the season goes on. And, you know, it starts, if you can win at Michigan, holy cow, does that put a little different complexion on where you are right now in the season?
Yeah, I mean, look, 8-12 in the Big Ten with the right eight wins is going to put you in the NCAA tournament. You don't have to be 500. There are going to be some sub-500 Big Ten teams in the tournament. By the way, Dante Scott, to me, has improved so much. 500. There are going to be some sub-500 Big Ten teams in the tournament. By the way, Dante Scott, to me, has improved so much from last year. I think he's become a really, really good player. I got to run. Yeah. You're on the call tonight with John and Walt, 7 o'clock tip at Michigan. A little bit of a get back game with the way Hunter Dickinson behaved in the game on New Year's Eve, but a tough task for sure. Thanks as always.
All right, Kev. See you.
Chris Inaki, everybody. Up next, Mark Zuckerman, our Nats insider, on the acquisition of John Lester. Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980, Team980.com.
What's trending on the Team 980?
All right, and what's trending is brought to you today by our daily sports line, the DC Lottery's new sportsbook, Gambit DC. Download today at gambitdc.com. That's GAMBETDC.com to access spreads, money lines, over unders, live in game betting, all at your fingertips. It's sports, it's only better. All right, from John Keim, this just broke in the last 15 minutes. John Keim reporting that Washington will make Marty Herney its new general manager. Marty Herney, who spent 5 seasons in Carolina with Ron Rivera. Now, first reported yesterday by Ian Rappaport that they were meeting and that it could happen. John Keim reporting that Washington is expected to make Marty Herney its new general manager. We talked a lot about it with David Newton. If you missed that interview from earlier in the hour, you'll be able to rewind to listen to that on the radio.com app. Wizards game in Charlotte canceled. The Nats signed John Lester to a one-year deal. Caps and Pens tonight in Pittsburgh. Maryland at Michigan tonight right here on the Team 980. And also, we talked about this earlier in the show, but Jared Porter, the new GM for the Mets, was fired this morning, one day after it was reported that he had sent explicit text messages to a foreign reporter in 2016. Mark Zuckerman is our Nats insider. He joins us right now. All right, the Nats signed John Lester. They've got a fourth starter. We were wondering who it was going to be. Your reaction to that deal is what?
This is the guy I was thinking all along made the most sense based on what we've known, what they've done before, based on the finances of it. They weren't going to go spend huge money on a Trevor Bauer who's going to get, you know, $100 million plus. But we also know that Mike Rizzo likes veterans with proven track records, guys who've won championships before. This guy has won 3 titles with the Red Sox and the Cubs. Yeah, he's 37. He's not what he used to be. He's not an ace anymore, but they don't need him to be that. They just need him to take the ball every 5 days, give them a chance to win, which is something that he has done consistently his entire career. He's always been healthy. And you know, help them win some big games. And then if they do get to October, you've got one of the most experienced and successful postseason pitchers ever. Now your rotation is your number four guy. So it made a lot of sense to me. It doesn't mean it's guaranteed to work out. I mean, he could be a bust. He may be finished at age 37. But for what it looks like is going to be $5 million guaranteed, that to me is exactly the type of pitcher that we're looking for to fill out the rotation.
He's essentially replacing Anibal Sanchez and potentially Joe Ross, who could have been a fourth starter. Why didn't Chicago make a stronger move to keep him? Isn't that a concern?
Well, yes. I think there's two things there. Yes, there could be a concern that they think that he's just done, that he doesn't have a lot left in him. But I think the greater concern, this is, you're seeing what the Cubs are doing across the board this winter. They're dismantling that team that won a World Series, what, only a little over 4 years ago. A bunch of guys, Schwarber, non-tendered. There have been talks of trading Chris Bryant. Obviously, Lester is gone now. I mean, the reaction in Chicago last night was not a positive one, that he wanted to come back and would have taken a very low salary from them. And they said no. So to me, that strikes me as they are undergoing a complete overhaul there. They are not intending to try to win right now. They're trying to rebuild. And here now in D.C., he's got a chance in his mind and in the team's mind to win again. But, yeah, there's always a little bit of a concern there. The one thing I would say is, if you're worried about the Cubs think he's done, well, David Martinez and Jim Hickey, who is the Nats' new pitching coach,
right,
and used to be the Cubs' pitching coach, they know John Lester. So this isn't just, we've heard of him, we're going to take a chance on him. These guys know him well and know him recently. So I would imagine that they have to feel down like this guy's still got a lot left in the tank.
Mike Rizzo, we're talking to Mark Zuckerman, our Nats insider. When it comes to what he thinks first, second, and third, it is starting pitching, isn't it? Over the years, the moves he's made and what he's thought of before anything else?
100%. I keep going back to his first championship team he was a part of was the 2001 Diamondbacks. How was that team built? Dominant rotation, Curt Schilling and Randy Johnson. And then a bunch of veteran professional hitters in their lineup, and then make the rest work, including a bullpen that was very shaky. They won a title that way, and in my mind, he has always viewed that as the blueprint for winning a championship. And what have we seen over more than a decade now in D.C.? That's been what he's tried to do, and it worked in 2019. It hasn't worked every year that he's attempted to do it, but I think he believes unquestionably the best way to win a title is to have a great rotation. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought. I'm sorry.
I'm just going to say, look, none of these guys are sure things. Scherzer's coming off a down year, getting older.
Right.
Strasburg was injured all last year. Corbin was down last year. Lester was down last year. It could blow up spectacularly, but you still have these guys under contract. All of them are together for one more year. To me, this says we're still trying to win this year, and the way we're going to win is with starting pitching.
Yeah, you just answered my next question, is sort of the status, health-wise and otherwise, of the rest of what, at least name-wise, looks like one of the strongest starting rotations in baseball. We're talking to Mark Zuckerman, our Nats insider. Of course, you can follow Mark on Twitter, at Mark Zuckerman, and Zuck, of course, writes for massandsports.com and covers the team for Mass and Sports. Is Daniel Hudson the default closer? And what does the rest of the bullpen look like? I know Will Harris is still there, and Tanner Rainey. There's no other closer other than Daniel Hudson on this roster, right?
Probably not as things stand right now, but let's still see what else they do. I think they're going to try to get another left-hander, a guy with some experience to pitch late in games. They could re-sign Sean Doolittle. There are other guys. Brad Hand is the big name that's out there as a lefty who could hold that role. I think what was interesting is when they were most effective was when Hudson and Doolittle kind of shared the job and they just kicked on matchups and it was fresh. I think they'd like to do that. Hudson's not a big ego guy. He doesn't have a great track record as a closer. Obviously, he was great at the end of 2019. I think they wouldn't mind having it more of a committee if you find the right guy that fits in with that. I also think at some point, and I don't know whether it's going to happen during the 21 season or down the road, but I think Rainey's going to end up being their closer. He's got a great arm. He's made some big strides the last couple of years, growing a lot more confident. He's got the stuff, and I think it's only a matter of time before that happens. But if, you know, you're assembling your bullpen today, yeah, it's Hudson. But I think there will be a lefty to at least set him up, if not maybe share some of the closing duties with him.
Thanks for jumping on short notice. It's always appreciated. We'll talk a lot more as we approach the season. Appreciate it, Mark.
Sounds good. Good talk to Kevin.
At Mark Zuckerman on Twitter. Thanks to Mark. Thanks to Chris Nockey. Thanks to David Newton. Thanks to Ryan, who produced us today. Again, the breaking news from John Keim is Marty Herney is going to be the next general manager for the Washington football team. Galdi, you'll have a lot more of that coming up next.